Blog Talk Radio.
Larson.
Good morning, Paula.
You know, this is the day that the Lord has made. We should rejoice and be glad in it. It's a beautiful, beautiful morning, and I'm thrilled today because we have an amazing guest. Our guest this morning is Sally Morgenthaler. Sally, did I pronounce your name right?
Oh, you did. When you're north of the Mason-Dixon, you say it Thaler. And South Sailor, if anybody even remembers where that line is, you're
good, because you know you never know until you hear somebody say it. And I've loved it. I've loved names so many times before that.
Oh yes,
I'm glad to know that. Sally is a remarkable Christian, emergent Christian minister. Correct me if I'm saying anything incorrect. I mean, I've researched your history a bit, and I'm thrilled to have you because you're a remarkable woman, and you're a prolific writer. You're somebody who gets things done in the world and doesn't say, you know, why are they this way, but goes out and strives and works to make them better. And you've really made a name for yourself in the world, working very hard to elevate our thinking. And I think that's where, as a planet, where we need to be. And I have researched from you online that your specialty is worship.
It has been, yes.
It's near and dear to my heart and to Crystalline's heart and to all of our listeners. I know that we want to come closer to our God. And we want to know him better, and we want to love him more, and anything that brings him closer to us and brings us closer to him is a good thing.
Yeah.
And you're an empowered woman and a strong woman, and you empower women, and I salute you for that. So thank you so much for coming and joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And welcome to our show.
Thank you both, Crystal and Paula. Thank you very much for that. I listen to that and I think, oh, gee, am I all those things? Well, I don't know if I am or not, but you've stated it very well, though, just in terms of interacting with the world in a way that we help evolve it. We help move it forward. We help each other to come to new insights, to come to new points of light and enlightenment about our experience, about who God is, who we are. And I feel privileged to be able to partner with others in doing that. I think we do that collectively. There's not one person. It is this, more than ever, this collaborative effort. Actually, it's collaborative play in this universe that God has given us to know the mystery of this, to plumb the mystery of the sacred even more, to also have this attitude of humility. I had a friend who said, you know, I can't be an atheist because I need to wake up in the morning and I need to be able to say thank you.
Mm.
And for me, I think that is explains my earliest of experiences, that the world is just such an amazingly beautiful, rich place, that my first response is I've got to express back what I'm feeling. This morning I woke up in Palm Springs. I'm out here on a work retreat, and the sun was just peeking through, and there was a bank of clouds. Actually, there was a very dense layer of clouds on top, so the sun was peeking through in this horizontal beam toward the mountains, the Stark Mountains, and I don't think I've ever seen more vibrant color. It just seemed all focused on these rocks, and I just thought again, I am so privileged to be alive in this moment, to take a breath, to have sight, to hear the turtle doves and the birds, and my response was, wow, and worship is the wow back to God. That's the basis of my experience. So thank you.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I just got back from Puerto Penasco, and my experience was very similar. It's just every day for it to be from the Rocky Mountains, and you know, the Mile High City, as you so well know, because you're a native of the Denver area too, or at least of Colorado, and to see the brilliant aqua of the ocean set against the blue of the sky, and the golden and maroon colors of the earth all together, and the beach was just white and soft. It was one of the softest beaches I've ever been in. It was really a thrill every day for 7 days to see that change of scenery was, and of course I love to be close to the ocean, because it feels like mother energy to me. It's like being bathed in the divine sacred feminine. You know, the mother is the place of life. You know, the ocean is the mother. That's where all life started on this planet. So,
yep, definitely. Well, I guess we all have this experience of wow, then, that we can start with that.
Well, and I think wow is a really great segue, frankly, into worship. And I'd like to hear, you know, one of your sort of probably best known for your book on worship evangelism.
Yeah, that terrible title.
Pardon me?
A lot of people thought it was a terrible title, but it was actually worship evangelism, actually a way to get people to read about worship in a new way. So,
well, and that's how I read it. I mean, I really liked it, the title, but I'm maybe coming from a different place. But The wow factor for me is really critical. I've had this conversation with some of our listeners and with Paula before, but probably 25 years ago, my brother and I were talking about how worship must really be designed to be something that's quite a bit different from what traditionally it's meant in a church setting or in a temple setting or in a lot of different types of formal religious settings, because it seems to me that it really should be or is supposed to be that wow experience, that awesome acknowledgement of sort of truth, beauty, and goodness, and this waking up feeling just amazed by what we can see and feel and experience around us, and visual beauty, like the colors you were talking about, really seem to inspire me in that way. Also, topographical beauty, you know, like mountains and canyons and really unique rock formations and those types of things are other ways that we can really just get blown away by how beautiful this place is where we live.
Yeah. And I think for many people, worshiping in a building, there are some deep truths and some marvelous traditions that we attach to, whatever tradition we come out of, whether it's Jewish, it's Buddhist, it's Shinto, it's Christian. I think these traditions are metaphors for larger reality, and they help to anchor us. They help to attach us to a larger reality. But sometimes those traditions can go the opposite way. They start to detach us from the larger reality. I see that improving our worship is helping to move back so that what we are doing in any kind of a service or event or ritual reattaches us to the world, quote-unquote, out there, the world that where we live and breathe and have our being, as the Greek poet would say, every day. And that's been both my frustration and my own journey, that separation of in my own Christian tradition, where experiencing many worship services as separation from the larger creation and the larger universe, trying to move back, bringing the God who is omnipresent, in the Christian tradition, omnipowerful, omnipotent, omniscient, bringing that God back into the sanctuary so that we can erase, we can blur the lines, erase the barriers. I have a favorite author, Barbara Brown Taylor, Altar in the World. That's a book that she wrote a few years ago. And it's just a marvelous picture of how we can erase those lines. And I'm just going to quote from that book if I will. She's just such a marvelous writer. Most of us have forgotten that the whole world is the house of God. Somewhere along the line, we bought or were sold the idea that God is chiefly interested in buildings. But when "surely this is the house of God" came out of Jacob's mouth, there was no temple in Jerusalem without one designated place to make their offerings. People were free to see the whole world as an altar. The divine could erupt anywhere, and when it did, they marked the spot in any way they could. And I believe that is now, at this juncture in history, we have the need to see the whole world as the altar of God. In not seeing the world that way, we can, as Duane Elgin talks about, we can see the world as a dumping ground. We can see it as just a collection of inert, dead resources for our use. And when we see the world that way, we do certain things, which we've done for the last 300 or 400 years in the Industrial Revolution and beyond. The world is something to be used rather than to stand in wonder of and to participate with in the emergence of new life. And so how we see God and what we see as worship are really, really critical, especially at this juncture. So I think that's meant the basis of how I respond to life. And when I use the word worship, I hope that you as listeners, whoever you are, whatever tradition that you come out of, simply look at it in the light of connecting with God and the beauty, truth, goodness, as Crystal Lynn talked about. I that is how I see it at the very root. I think in terms of what we see as reality, that's how we present ourselves in worship, and that's been changing for me. I think that in our journey of faith, we go from we grow out of certain ways of viewing reality into others, and also our culture does. And in terms of Western culture, we have grown from seeing reality as matter, as empirical, as stuff, to now scientists have moved into a different view, matter as energy. So there are a lot of us who are seeing the world in a more holistic way instead of just things. At the basis of things is energy, and basis of relationships is energy that is passed between us. And yet there's another step in terms of how we see reality. Scientists are now telling us it's not just energy. It is fields of potentiality. And I think this, in terms of my own evolution as to how I see myself interacting with what is, instead of just responding to stuff, that the world is stuff that I somehow get to manipulate or own or change in some way, but it's just stuff, to the energy that is more relational, to now co-creating with God or the universe, instead of just being present with it, it's to make, not just to be. And I remember the work of Dorothy Sayers, Mind of the Maker, where she, I think in a very prescient way, talked about us being co-creators with the universe. And that, I think, means a state of emergence, where we are in an expanding universe. We are called to make and remake every moment. And how exciting that is, to go from a static point where, well, we get to just rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, to we get to reinvent the boat. And
now, who was the author? You were just talking about Dorothy Sayers. What was the name of her book?
Mind of the Maker.
Mind of the Maker.
Yes.
Okay.
She was writing in the 40s. Theologian, artist, incredible woman. But she definitely interpreted Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament, as co-creative opportunity. Way before.
You know, and what you're saying to me, Sally, is that the world is more of what we bring to it than of what it brings to us. And, as you were speaking, I thought of a favorite story from The Master's Life in the Urantia book. And it's about his young years, his adolescence years. He was 18 at the time. And just, I want to read this. It's just a paragraph, but you'll see why this came to mind while you were saying what you had to say there. It says, for 4 years, their standard of living had steadily declined. The book earlier on says that Joseph was killed in a fall from a rigging while working on the governor's palace in Sepphoris. Year by year, they felt the pinch of increasing poverty. By the close of this year, they faced one of the most difficult experiences of all their uphill struggles. James had not yet begun to earn much, and the expenses of a funeral on top of everything else, again, it's like Jesus' baby brother Amos died when he was about 8 months old. The expenses of a funeral on top of everything else staggered them. But Jesus would only say to his anxious and grieving mother, Mother Mary, sorrow will not help us. We are all doing our best, and Mother's smile, perchance, might even inspire us to do better. Day by day, We are strengthened for these tasks by our hope of better days ahead. His sturdy and practical optimism was truly contagious. All the children lived in an atmosphere of anticipation of better times and better things, and this hopeful courage contributed mightily to the development of strong and noble characters in spite of the depressiveness of their poverty.
Well, well.
And that came to me, him saying to his mother, because I thought of that so many times, you know, what would it be like to have these children, he was the oldest of eight, and to have lost your husband and now you've lost your baby son, and your oldest is trying to be the father to this family, but you're grieving. And I've put myself in that position of loss and grieving and how that must have felt to be her.
Well,
in that situation, in that poverty, they lost the main breadwinner in their family. He was killed, and now their oldest sons had to provide for the family, and they were all struggling, and they were descending into poverty, and it was just dire.
Yeah.
And he said to her, and mother's smile, perchance, might even inspire us to do better. And I think about that, the place that smile comes from, even when your own heart is broken. You know, and the courage it takes to make other people, to help them, you know, not make them, but help them find their hope so that they can carry on. And then in doing that, you can carry on, you know.
Yeah. And nature
you
knows
do it.
This so well. I mean, if you went to Yellowstone 15, 8, some years ago, I think it was 12 to 15, Maybe not that long when we had Yellowstone experience such a devastating fire. And you go back.
I was actually there that week.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so what year was it? I may be extending it a little bit too much. It was mid.
No, actually, it was a lot. It was further back. It was about 22 years ago, 23 years ago.
Well, that just seems like yesterday. And then there's Mount St. Helens, and then... You know, we've got, a lot of recent devastation, and not to minimize at all the horror of what's happened in Japan. But
oh, my God.
In these moments, and I think all of you listeners, you can think to a point in your life recently, maybe it's far past, where you really thought all hope was gone, that you got to this point of no, what you thought was no return. There is no coming back. Life has ended in the way that you had known it.
Yeah, life as you knew it.
As you knew it, but that's the operative phrase, as we know it, and how the universe presses us into growth, that wonder is not all beautiful. There is wonder in devastation. It is horrific. We don't ask for it. We don't want it. We don't bless it in the way that, oh, you know, this was supposed to happen and this is God's will. I'm not saying those things. But when we have these crises that will happen and devastation in our lives, that cliche, what are we going to do with it? But I'd like to just open that up. What is the universe doing with it? As we say yes to a new way of perceiving the moment, life as we know it has changed. And when we try to hang on to what we knew, that's when we are operating in a degenerative way. To move into a generative, co-creative, emergent way is to ask the new question, what don't we know that will bring change? How can, even if I cannot apprehend it with my mind, how can I open my soul, my spirit, my way of being up to a new avenue, a new path? I love the poetry of William Stafford. And one of my favorite poems comes from his book, A Course in Creative Writing. And I just want to read this, because I think more than any philosophy, new thought, paradigm. Art moves me, and this moves me. They want a wilderness with a map. But how about errors that give a new start? Or leaves that are edging into the light? Or the many places a road can't find? Maybe there's a land where you have to sing to explain anything. You blow a little whistle just right, and the next tree you meet is itself. And many a tree is not there yet. Things come toward you when you walk. You go along singing a song that says where you are going becomes its own because you start. You blow a little whistle and a new world begins under the map. I think that more than anything describes where I have come in my life through experiences, just as you read earlier about this situation that seems hopeless. Out of that comes this new life and a way forward into a world that I'd never experienced. I can remember a time, and this gets into some of my own personal journey, where we'd had a traumatic shift in my family. I married at age 22, wonderful man. He began pastoring a church and then went on to plant a new church. Things were not going well. And I just knew that he was struggling deeply in his own soul, but I didn't really know the depth of it. And he had become addicted to pornography, and long story short, he molested my daughter's best friend. And
wow.
Our lives, from that moment on, I felt like I was in that point of no manual prepared me for this. Nothing that my parents had taught me, nothing that I had learned up until that point had prepared me for what happened next and the legal ramifications and all of that. And he was taken out of the home and into just a series of what ended up being 16 years of just grueling legal and probationary, programmatic realities and what it meant for our family. And it was a few months after the girl's family had come forward and my husband was going through the criminal proceedings, that I was with my mother, and my daughter at that time was 10. And we had gone somewhere to a garden in the Denver area, and we were walking through this garden, and my daughter was walking ahead of us. And as you can imagine, we were simply trying to find peace wherever we could find it. My mother turned to me and said, "What are you going to do?" Her life, my daughter's life, is ruined. It's ruined. And I, not knowing why I did what I did, I turned to her and said, "That cannot be further from the truth." And I, in that moment, also saw myself in a new way, in a new role with her. I was not just her mother, but I became the caretaker of hope for her.
Mm.
And the conduit of a message that then became just a constant mantra that you are not a victim. Not only that, but you were created for such a time as this. You are the co-creator of your life. And that daughter moved through with great difficulty, I must tell you. The darkness was pretty deep. But she moved through her middle school and high school years into college, and with each passing day became one of the most extraordinary individuals that I know. She is now getting her doctorate in psychology. She's 26 years old, mother of a two-year-old. Her compassion toward human beings, it's just amazing. And she told me about a year ago, she said, Mom, I think I'm going to go in this one direction with psychology. She said, I know I could open a clinical practice and I could be, you know, helping people sort of in a normal way, you know, get over depression, more or less normal people. I could help them function in a better way, more generative way. But I really feel called to help those who are terminally ill or chronically ill and help the people around them. And so she has begun an internship at National Jewish where she is intensely involved with parents of children who have cancer or other chronic illnesses. And she continually has placed herself in those junctures of life where people are experiencing incredible crises, I think because she knows that territory and she wants to make a difference there. And I think she wants to be able to bring the same message of co-creativity, of not only hope, but a world beyond imagination that it is there awaiting. The world that we didn't know, the world as we don't know it.
And wrapped up in what you just said is that word, which, you know, I have to admit, I am so intrigued that with this word emergent and emergence and emerge, and because that word in itself has so much hope in it.
Yeah.
When you emerge. I had an experience one day where I was really contemplating the circumstance of humanity. And I know Crystalline and I, and so many of the folks that listen to this show, like you, Sally, we really want to help the world emerge into a newer place. And, you know, it's as Jesus said, the old things are passing away. Behold, all things are becoming new. And that is about emergence. Things do emerge and evolve, and they do become new. And in that emergence is there. You know, I was praying about this, and I saw in a vision the chrysalis of a butterfly, and that it is so thin that, you know, when the butterfly surrenders its consciousness, let's say, and goes into this deep metamorphosis. In a way, it's such a great metaphor for faith because it just knows it will emerge.
Yeah.
And as it gets ready to be born as a butterfly, the chrysalis begins to, you know, get thin, and then the new creature breaks through. And what I saw was just this very thin veil. That it's so thin now, we could pierce it easily. We could pierce it with our faith, but we don't seem to know that's what we need to do, you know. But it's coming to us, and you can see. You read the signs of the spiritual springtime, and you can see that humanity is hungry for something else. All of these things, you know. You mentioned your husband's addiction. All of these substances, whatever we use to replace God, to replace the real joy in our lives, the thing that is endless joy in our lives, the wonder of the beauty of the natural world, the wonder in the laugh of a child, the joy in seeing a baby grow up to be an adult, miracles all around us, and yet we want to numb ourselves and dumb ourselves down, and so that we don't feel the pain.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, when we embrace the emergence, you have to go through the pain. We have a friend who says, resistance is what you add to pain to make it hurt worse and last longer.
That's so true. Very true. Wow, do I know that in my life. I have a friend who constantly, at least used to, talk about building a bridge and getting over it, and I thought, well, that sounds nice, but actually the real I think that the real success, and I'm just going to talk about that in an emergent way so that something new is born, comes in walking straight through it. And the psalmist, Christian psalmody was taken really, the whole Hebraic psalmody was transported into the Christian early experience, and then Old Testament, New Testament, we get that richness of the old view, which is a holistic view of life, rather than much of Western Christianity separates that which isn't perfect. It comes out of a Platonic view of life that the ideal, that what is spiritual is just the ideal. But we don't get that in the Psalms. We get more of lament in the Psalms and bemoaning. Here I sit in this dry desert waiting, you know, for you, God. And where are you? Out of the depths I cry to you. The Elijah sitting under a leaf and complaining, you know, I'm here by myself. I alone am left. Or we get Job, who, you know, whose wife said, well, you just need to curse God and die. And finally, Job gets to the point where he does argue with God and says, why? Why have you taken all this from me? This is not an unspiritual act.
Mm.
When we embrace and we name the pain, we have to also remember that the caterpillar liquefies before
right. It
can form that butterfly. That is deconstruction.
Right. It's kind of that old saying, you know, you have to die in order to live. You have to give everything away in order to have anything. There are all of these paradoxes, and that are expressed in almost all doctrine.
Yeah.
Almost all spiritual doctrine has some way of saying that, you know, that the self has to die in order
and
to be reborn.
No, you're right.
And we don't really, you know, like, at least I didn't really understand that until I've gone through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you really can understand that until you've gone through it. And then it has a tremendous meaning. And in relationship to faith, that it's like all of the doctrine or dogma or ritual or theology or whatever it was that you were holding on to in thinking that this is all there is, and I must somehow get everything I need from this sort of limited resource. When you go through that kind of losing everything that you thought was real, and then coming out on this other side and finding what's on the other side was so much more real.
Yeah.
It can be quite a transformational experience.
Yes, walking straight through it. It's something that we try to avoid as much as possible. Whatever religious tradition, there are some rituals in all of our traditions that help us to recontext the pain and to experience it, but that are there are others. We have this mix in our traditions. It's almost a schizophrenia. And whatever, as listeners, whatever your tradition is, you can probably name those parts of your tradition that actually help you engage with pain in a generative way, but others that call you to avoid it. And I think that just psychologically speaking, the grief process calls us to engage with it.
Right.
Certainly not to stay there, but to be there long enough to be able to move into a different place, because it seems to be the case that we cannot move to that different place unless we acknowledge where we are, acknowledge what has happened and what we have lost. And so those traditions, for all of you listening, that help you to engage somehow in the pain meaningfully and deeply enough to be able to move forward, that's really, really helpful. For me, walking the labyrinth helps me to do that because it's so concrete and I can name the various struggles, at different points. For Psalms of Lament help me to do that. One of the things that I also like to name is that in the West, in Western traditions, we try to escape pain by thinking about the hereafter. And that can be a hopeful thought for some of you, but for some, it can take away the here and now, and so that we don't deal with it, we live in denial.
Our
escape is that ticket to heaven. All of our great traditions provide escape in some ways. They provide really great things, but in the West, we escape by getting our ticket to heaven. And in the Eastern traditions, escape is, transcendence. And transcendence can be good, but if we don't allow ourselves to be present with this stuff that we struggle with, if we simply want to transcend it and not deal with it, then that too is not helpful. So yes, this being with the reality. I want to give you a part B of my journey with my husband, who is now my former husband, but there is a wonderful, here is emergence, in a way, again, that place I could never imagine. So what do you do with this brokenness? And we did divorce after many years of dealing with his addiction, and he was in and out of county jail and then went to federal prison. And my daughter, as she grew through high school and college, wanted to reconnect with him at many of those stages. And at some points it was possible, and she had to do it in a counseling environment because she was still underage. But she kept pressing for a relationship with him. And she was absolutely determined that she was going to have a relationship with him, which is also just one of her traits. And so she is now 26.
And you were married through most of that time, is that correct?
We were married up until
right away.
We did not get divorced right away. I would say from the time that he was convicted of a felony until our divorce was about 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't be with the family most of that time. And I found it just became untenable, and he was convicted of a second felony and then was sentenced to 8 years in a halfway house. And our marriage was just became impossible. So when he got out of county jail and was going to be going into a halfway house, I then filed for divorce, and we divorced at that point before he went into the halfway house situation. So that was when my daughter was going. She was in high school at that point she was going into high school when we divorced, and she just. It was a such a hard time for her, but she became determined to reconnect with him. Fast forward to 3 years ago, he was just getting out of prison, and he had paid his debt to society, and I was not in town. My son went to the prison to pick him up. It was a reverse prodigal son. He was given $100, which is the same $100 they used to give prisoners in the mid-70s. So our system is pretty broken. What can you do with $100 now? The support for those who get out of prison is so minimal that it's no wonder that we just have this cycling back in. But my son went down to pick him up and took him out for a steak dinner. But he had $100 to his name. And he ended up moving in with my daughter and her husband. And they had an extra room for him. And he had nothing. And he just tried to start life again. He was able to get a car. My daughter and her husband helped him to do that. And then he tried to get a job. And as you can imagine, the many strikes against him, there was a bankruptcy and a couple felonies. He lived with them for a year. And in the meantime, my daughter had a child. And anyway, I fast forward also for me, I've remarried, and my husband now saw this situation, and he ended up giving my former husband a position in a new company.
Wow.
And this new family is, it's just an amazing experience. We are together for holidays, for just life. And we have this grandchild together, and my children are able to experience a father that they had not had for many years. And I can't really take credit for this. All I can say is that 3 years ago, when my former husband got out of prison, my heart opened up, and I realized I had so much anger that I needed to let go of, and I needed to be liquefied, deconstructed. And my daughter was the way forward. She was the one who had the vision for a new family and a new way of being. And I believe that in her co-creating with the universe, created a space, a new space for all of us to be, as well as my new husband, who saw the way to be able to give this man a chance. Nobody was giving him a chance. He had tried and tried. And so I just put that forward as one point, small point of emergence on this planet, in this universe. But I call all of you listeners to think now, not back to the point where there was no return, that life as you knew it was gone, but the points of emergence, the new pathways that were being created, you blow a little whistle, and a world begins under the map. And all
under the what?
Under the map. You know, we like to draw maps, but sometimes a world begins without a map. And that's the way it was in my situation. I would never have been able to draw the map of what that was going to be. And I wonder what incredible stories that our listeners would tell of emergence, of the impossible. I think of the story of Picasso when he's on a train and a man comes up to him and asks him if he's Picasso. He says yes, and he says, "You know, you draw people so strangely. I wish you would draw them as they are." And so Picasso said, "Well, what do you mean, as they are?" So he took out a little picture of his wife. And he said, "Well, this is how people really look. Look at my wife. This is how she really looks." And Picasso said, "Isn't she rather one-dimensional?" And really, what is reality?
Well, he was drawing them. He was drawing them as they are in his eye, in the artist's eye.
Yep.
The artist sees more than what the eye sees. If you look at somebody with your soul, if you look at their soul, you might see something more than what you're seeing. And I think that's what Picasso was trying to say. He saw more. And that's what makes his art timeless and priceless.
Yeah.
And because he saw something others didn't see, a complexity that was transcendental. And, you know, Sally, what you're saying to me, it just resonates so deeply, that because this is a very difficult life.
Yeah.
And perhaps I believe that it is the most difficult, that they get easier after this. This one is like this is where the steel is forged, you know?
Mm.
The steel of your character. And you know, your story about your daughter, it resonates so deeply with me because I have a similar story. My husband was my first husband. I was married right out of high school, and he was very abusive to my little girl. And he was a misogynist. He didn't really like women anyway, and he never wanted a daughter. And once our son was born, it was like she didn't exist.
Mm.
And then he died when she was 7, and he left all of these issues that for her were not resolvable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She just, and your story about your own daughter and the reverse prodigal son, which is such a precious story. I mean, really, if we think God doesn't love us, we should read that story again and again until we get it.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, the prodigal son went off into a far land and he squandered everything and he did everything his father wouldn't want him to do. And then he came to a moment of emergence where he realized while he was working in the field of some taskmaster, I could go home and work in my own father's field. He's much kinder to me than this taskmaster. He's much kinder to his, to his servants than this man is. I could go work for my own father and be treated better than this.
Yeah.
I'm going to
go
home
yeah.
to my father, who will treat me better even as a servant than this taskmaster. And so he, in that moment where he does just what you said, he blows the whistle. He says, enough. I'm going to swallow my pride and go back and face the music with my own father. And what does his father do? He runs out with joy. And what parent doesn't get this story? Anybody who is a loving parent who loves their children.
Mm-hmm.
Our children are so precious to us.
Yeah.
My son has come home.
Yeah.
And where's his robe? And kill the fatted calf. And let's have a big party because my son, who was lost, has come home.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. My son took his dad out for a steak.
Right. The other thing that really moves me about the story about your children and your new husband, but especially your children, I get the sense that you were able to transform your relationship with your ex in partly because of your daughter's need. Your daughter's need to continue to have a relationship with him, it would be impossible for you to stay in a state of anger, judgment, betrayal for too long, because as a mother, you needed to take care of her needs.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
So there's this part of the relationship or the connection between related and unrelated people that forces us to really live in that family of God or fellowship of God or kingdom of God, depending on your language and your preferences. But that place that forces us to continue to maintain relationships with each other.
Yes.
And ironically, I mean, the name of our show is Cosmic Citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most inspiring talks that I ever heard, a speech by a friend of ours named Paul Snyder, who talked about what does it take to raise cosmic citizens?
Yeah.
What in us do we need to emulate? And in order for them to really get their place in the universe. And one of the things he said was that in practicing forgiveness and in living in tolerance, we have to really struggle with the meaning of that word and define it for ourselves in a new way, that forgiveness is for those who don't deserve it. If we deserved it, that would be justice.
Mm-hmm.
So there really are no sinners or there are no mistakes that we make that are unforgivable, that make us no longer, you know, someone to be part of the family.
Yes.
And I really salute you and your family for the inclusiveness of this new sense of family, this emergent family that you've created, that encompassed and included your new husband, for him to have the type of heart necessary to make that offer is really a profound thing.
This story has changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel so privileged to be part of an experience like this, and I do mean that part. I didn't think it up, strategize it. The one thing I can say that I did was that I opened my soul to what was possible. But I'm not smart enough to create it, and I certainly was not humble enough to be able to walk into it without help. And part of that help came in just the divine, just opening up, revelation, revealing of my state of anger and bitterness and hostility. And I needed to face that, let that be liquefied, just as the caterpillar. I needed to be able to open to that. But I do feel that certainly was divine revelation. It wasn't me of myself coming to this enlightened moment. It was given to me, and then I just followed it. And I think that my best self, the self that is most generative in this world, and maybe you as listeners can relate to this, it's at those points where I give myself over to the greater thing that is happening, that I simply try to increase my awareness of what is going on in this moment and participate with it. And that is, I feel so privileged to have been a part of that process, that 3 years ago, I simply got to the point, and I'll tell you how it happened. I went down to the prison to see my ex-husband just about a couple weeks before he was to get out. And it was a selfish act. I was concerned about the effect of him being out and free, really, for the first time in 16 years, free to do what he wanted, no supervision, really.
Mm-hmm.
I was concerned about that for the family, for myself. And when I got there, there's this cafeteria. They, you know, we all sit in this place with a bunch of tables, and then the prisoners come into the room, and we can sit for however long, 6 hours. 6 hours. He and I had never had closure about what had happened.
I'll bet.
Never.
I can imagine.
And I, face-to-face with him, was just given a view of him that was so much larger. I mean, it was a divine view instead of my own view of what he had done to me or to the children. It was as if I was looking at him with divine eyes. And I've never had that experience before. I left there and got on the bus. You have to just kind of strip down. I mean, you got your clothes, but, you know, anything that you might be considered a weapon, you have to go through that process. It's almost like TSA, airport security, on big steroids. And so you get your personal things back, and you
airport
get on this bus.
Security times 10.
Oh, yes. And I'd done it at the county jails, but it was very way different at the prison. But that changed me. I remember riding back on the bus to the parking lot, and I knew I'd changed. I knew everything was going to be different because I not so much gotten out of the way, but a certain part of me had been cleared out so that I could now participate in a new thing that God was doing with my husband and in the larger sphere of family and society. And I knew that I couldn't see the future, but that I was going to be part of a new thing. And now he manages himself day by day. My daughter talks with him a lot, and she said, you know, he just has such an aversion to his former life and his former behavior that he just doesn't want to get anywhere close to the things he used to do. He is so thrilled to have somewhat of a normal life, to have work to do, to be able to help the children. He cleans their houses. He cooks for them. He can't stop doing for them. He feels like he's lost so much time, and all he wants to do is to be this positive presence in their lives.
To be of service to them in some way.
To be of service. And I think, too, in a larger way, of going beyond mere reconciliation, which is really good, but to remaking. Instead of reconciling with others and reconciling with God and reconciling the universe, and we talk about that a lot in Christian circles, forward to remaking our relationships, remaking the world, remaking the universe. And I believe this new heaven and the new earth that we hear about in Revelation, I believe that is what we are about now.
I have a question. You know, I don't know if you can answer it, but I'm curious because of the fact that this is a man who was an ordained minister who had dedicated his life to God at an early age and then had this addiction issue, which was a really big deal in that circle. I mean, probably couldn't do much worse than that in that circle. And so it was probably this real yin and yang, this really high positive and this really low negative, that was the reality of his life experience then. How does he feel now about God and about religion? I mean, is he still someone who has a belief in God?
Yes, very much. Yeah, very much. And he did not come to any kind of, definable or certainly strong faith until he was in his 20s. He had a conversion experience into Christianity. And then started studying for the ministry after that. But, yes, he still has a very strong faith. Now, here's where it gets difficult, though, because the prison where he was had a particularly strong spiritual emphasis. And I can just say that we sometimes complain about our tax dollars going to prisons. But at this particular prison, the counseling and the spiritual community was incredibly strong. And he was undergirded in a way that he never expected and came out with his faith so buttressed. And yet the dilemma has been, since he has been out trying to find spiritual community that will let him be who he is, past and all. So that dilemma is his faith got stronger, but he's not been able to find a group of people who will do what, I mean, religions claim all over the world that they do, and that is to make people into accepting, reconciling, forgiving people. But he's not been able, it's not that they don't exist, that the communities don't exist. For him, that's been hard to find, where he can come and be himself and not have to edit his past. As you can imagine, it's the worst of the worst. It's the scarlet letter.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
To carry as a sex offender. And I, by the way, I want to just reiterate here that it wasn't the rape, but it wasn't rape. It was molestation, which I'm not trying to say that I'm not trying to minimize that. And that certainly was horrible, but it didn't go, you know, to the worst of the worst. Still and all, this is it's a grievous thing that he did against this young woman, underage, and yet also he's not able, he cannot find his way forward to be able to at once own that, to not sugarcoat it, but to move forward in society as a generative part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be a place, I think we can expect this of spiritual communities, where a person like that could become yet a better person. And yet he's not been able to find a circle of acceptance and belonging.
I had an interesting experience in this last month in that started an online study group, and one of the members of the group mentioned that he had spent time in a penitentiary, and we don't know how much time, and we don't know for what crime. But one of the things that fascinated me about this experience, it's a study group on Skype, and we all come from all over the place and all different backgrounds and come together in this one unique area. But one of the things that fascinated me about that first day of introducing ourselves, is that no one asked him that question. Didn't ask him what he had done, didn't ask him, you know, how long he had been, you know, incarcerated. There was absolutely, it was just, oh, okay, so that's part of so-and-so's background. And I just thought that in and of itself was a new world for me.
Wow.
You know, that there is something happening about the way we do come together on the internet.
Yes.
And how we can come together as a result of the new communications and the new social networking systems that
yes.
that gives us a place to be ourselves and to be anonymous if we choose to be, or to share as much as we want to share. And the other thing that strikes me, and that strikes me about your daughter, is that she, I'm assuming, has grown up during this new era of
yeah.
Of openness and transparency that young people go through, that is very different from the world that we experienced in our youth or in our teenage years.
No,
where
you're right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, very much. Yeah. And she is now teaching. She's involved in a spiritual community and is helping high school, middle school, and high school girls navigate the just the, you know, the weird stuff that they have to navigate as young women in this new world, but they do it a lot on Skype and Facebook and in person. And you're right, there is a new level of openness and a desire, and sometimes some would say too much. Some would say we don't have boundaries on Facebook. We don't have we're learning. It's a new territory, and I think we're going to be learning for a while that we may share too much.
Absolutely.
I
know a lot of people who've had that experience too.
That we can share too much of ourselves, but there is a positive about this that we can, again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, name our journeys, tell our stories, and story has become really one of the most our most prized possessions, or how about currency? It is a prized currency that we share with each other. And for some of us, we've been raised in traditions where faith or spirituality is a journey out of the personal. And for others of us, we've been raised to really value the personal. I mean, whichever tradition you come out of, the one thing that we can say is that in a Facebook and Twitter world, stories becoming really, really paramount. The stories not only of individuals, but of tribes and cultures and nations. We see this with Egypt and Libya and Syria. We see this with people who are now empowered to tell each other their stories, to name what has happened to them, and to also co-create a new future. And so, narrative is really important. But I was raised in a family where you don't air your dirty laundry, you don't tell people what has happened to you. Even for me to share this on this call, sometimes I feel like, oh, yeah, I may be sharing too much for listeners, and I hope you'll draw me back if you feel that that's the case. But I do hope that
I
connection.
I think that we all grew up in a family like that, to tell you the truth. That was really, and for me, it is a form of materialism that it doesn't matter how things are, but just how they look. If they look fine, they are fine. But no, they're not really fine. And if we don't articulate why they're not fine, then we really can't fix them. We're all in denial then. If we all buy into that, and which I think our mothers and the 50s and the generation from then on, things had to look really good, but they didn't have to be good. And I think it's better that they are good than that they look good. It's okay if they don't look perfect, as long as they are honest and have integrity.
Wow.
You know, and to the degree that we keep the secrets, I have to say your ex-husband, and mine too somewhere, you know, has regret of the deepest kind. And a quote was posted from Jesus in the Urantia book, but he says to his apostles, "Make not the mistake of estimating the soul's worth by the imperfections of the mind, or by the appetites of the body. Judge not the soul, nor evaluate its destiny by the standard of a single unfortunate human episode. Your spiritual destiny is conditioned only by your spiritual longings and purposes."
That is wonderful.
Isn't that beautiful?
That is so wonderful. How do we see ourselves? So much we treat the world and treat others so often. By way of how we see ourselves and how we treat ourselves, and how is that going lately?
And how do we be compassionate towards ourselves as well as towards the world? I find, at least, it's those who have the hardest time being compassionate with themselves.
Yeah, I would agree.
Dealing
with
their own mistakes and their own, you know, just simple human foibles and tendencies. I like to use this analogy recently that we're only just a couple of DNA strands, you know, north of a primate. And
or
so,
Brian Swim would say a salmon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so some of our expectations of our fellows might be a bit high. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have high expectations of ourselves or that we don't want to aim high, but just that we also need to understand the level of animal that still exists within us.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to comment on this is that on this topic is that living in a culture that is so that has been or has had a history of real major, what I would say, sexual suppression or repression, and then moving suddenly. I mean, this is a suddenly moving into an age of this sort of promiscuity and sort of sexuality available everywhere, you know, on your billboards, on your television, on in your magazines. These visual stimuli that are so breaking the old taboos and the old molds, and that I think there's a large portion of our society that doesn't appreciate what a difficult time it is that we're going through with this type of transition. And to just share briefly, you know, my brother's experience when he was in China for a semester of school during right when they first opened China up to Western visitors. And so everyone was still wearing, you know, the Mao suit, male and female. There was just absolutely no sexuality visible through people's clothing or their expression.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, sorry. And that when he came back from that trip, he said he was aware of how much easier it had been on him as a young man of 19 or 20 to not have that kind of stimuli, to have been able to just totally focus on his school and the things he was supposed to be doing, because he wasn't constantly inundated with all of these sexual images.
Yeah,
we could go
really far afield. Well, it's not far afield. It's part of life, and it's a huge part of life that we all experience. And as women, how we experience our own sexuality and our gender moving through such a shift. One of the things that we do know, though, is that repressive cultures tend to have an accelerated or more concentrated use of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fundamentalist Christian or Amish, I'm not just trying to generalize and saying that you know you're always going to find it more there, but there's enough evidence to say that fundamentalism of any kind tends to drive it. And there's fundamentalism
exactly.
in all of our traditions. So I'm not
exactly.
I don't want to just zero in on those. But there's fundamentalism
right.
in all of our traditions that when we try to wall off the sensual, the more we try to wall it off, the more that we stop engaging with our bodies and affirming our just our embodiment, what it
mm-hmm.
is to be sexual. When we try to wall that off, we remove the tools that people historically have had.
I think we sort
to
of distort and we distort and confuse it.
We do
in a way.
Well, whenever we whenever we make something taboo, we add a whole nother level of intrigue and attraction to it. But, you know, I want to get back to something that we were touching on a bit ago, and that is that, you know, just the rigors of living a spiritual life in a difficult world. And Sally, you said your husband had found it difficult to find a community that was forgiving of his past, a spiritual community. And I find it, you know, it can be difficult, and I'm sure you've experienced this, that it's hard to find a spiritual community that is open to emergence. And you know, one of the reasons why you and your cohorts are heroes in my book is because you kind of face that dragon. And it's something you touched on early in the show. And that is that tradition and that dogma and those creeds that tend to take our spiritual life and crystallize it and fossilize it into something that, you know, is not manageable anymore in the real world that's living right now.
Yeah, you can't hardly liquefy.
Yeah, it can't liquefy. It's petrified, and you know, you're wanting to emerge, but your spiritual community is so dogmatic and rigid, is that we see these heroes like Carlton Pearson and others that come out and have the courage to say, you know what, I don't believe in hell anymore, I'm going to hold that up.
Yeah,
and
I don't believe in a God that would require that type of eternal punishment. At the same time, you know, calling himself merciful, or that we have
the ferocity of the, you know, when you confront people with something that is just really blatantly, when you look at God from the perspective even of just God that Jesus showed us, the loving Father.
Mm.
And say, but well, wait a minute, how does this work again?
Yeah.
And the ferocity of that, to face down these old beliefs, these petrified, crystallized beliefs, and help people emerge through those. And you know, let's face it, some of them aren't going to do that. But, you know, living a spiritual life on this planet is not easy. I guess that's my point. It just isn't easy. We talk about this stuff, like your experience with your husband. You went through a process, and it was a process of 16 years and more. It's not easy to get on the other side of some of these complex human problems we have. It just isn't. Rob Bell thinks, one of the person on the board expressed to me, Rob Bell is a person who has held up this concept of no hell. Hell is dead. You know, so whether we're overcoming sexual problems, addictions, addictions to sex, addictions to power, to greed, to, you know, you name it, whatever it is that the ego identifies with that is not God, and, you know, the ego self needs to die so that God, so the real identity, you know, Jesus called it being born again, and we know he's shifting the seat of our identity over to a new, more enduring reality. And that reality is the reality of the spirit. But it's not an easy thing to do. It's a process. And so that's
I've been a part of what's called a movement. Most of those of us at the beginning of the conversation, the emergent conversation within, well, I would say progressive evangelicalism. So those of you as listeners trying to place where I am, the sector that I'm talking about, those two words may seem like an oxymoron to you. As I'm say progressive evangelicalism, what possibly could be progressive about that? But there, in the late 90s, there were a group of mainly young men, but there were those of us who are women also involved, who were just looking at the approach, a dogmatic approach of evangelicalism, and saying towards Scripture, the interpretation of Scripture, and also just the Christian life, what really was at the base of it, and we were feeling that
evangelicals needed to do much of the work that had been done by theologians in the what we call the mainline, more progressive Christian world. We need to be able to look at Scripture in historical context, to look at the different genres of writing in Scripture, historical and textual criticism. Evangelicals really had not gone through that, maybe some on the more liberal side, but for the most part, evangelicals were stuck between in a range of the fundamentalist, where every word of Scripture is absolutely true, meaning even the metaphor, if you say God has wings, God has wings, to that's on the fundamentalist side, to what we would call more just more classic evangelicalism, that maybe we accept that there are some metaphors that describe God with human characteristics, but most of Scripture is to be taken literally. There are some evangelicals who don't believe in a seven-day creation, but nevertheless take the historical, the narrative of Scripture as being historical, pretty much beyond the 7 days. So the emergent community, as it grew up and manifested itself out of the late 90s, was really trying to wake evangelicals up to a new way of looking at God, and in many ways, I believe, a more developmental process of faith and a more studied view of what it has meant to be Christian. And there's definitely been a witch hunt out for those of us who identified with the emergent conversation. And I will say that I've been one of those, and I'm on the outside, and probably more on the outside than those bigger names within emergent. I at this point don't find myself teaching or speaking in Christian circles, but broader circles, so integral spiritual circles or evolutionary spiritual circles, and probably because I have just stepped out further from the Christian tradition. But
can
a developmental
you
view...
Share,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, can you share with us some of the things that you have been teaching during the times when you were in and out of those circles about, you know, sort of the transformational worship forms?
Well, worship, I was, in the last years of being involved with Emergent, I was really trying to help congregations, first of all, become collaborative in their worship planning. And we're talking about worship as an event. All of us worship 24 hours a day. We worship something and somehow understanding. It's an ongoing experience. But if we're just talking about a ritual, and in Christian circles that would be an hour on Sunday or Sunday night or Saturday night, I was trying to help leaders to become more collaborative so that worship then became more classic in terms of liturgy. Liturgy means the work of the people. In most congregations,
communal.
In most congregations, it's the work of the pastor or the priest and the organist or the musician. It's not something that we invite people to bring their stories, their talents, their gifts, their paintings, their videos, their litanies to. And so in this new world of interconnectedness that the internet has opened up for us, it has enabled all of us to become more empowered to bring what we have to bear on our sacred life communally. Mm-hmm. It's opportunity. That's what I see it. Opportunity and possibility. How many ways can God speak? How many ways do we have of knowing God beyond the cognitive? So we have all of these artistic colors in our palette. So whether it is the 12-year-olds who are going out and taking pictures in their community
of, let's say it's Good Friday, how many ways can we see Christ being crucified again in this community? Or maybe it is Earth Day. How many ways do we see the God of the universe being expressed in this community? How many generative ways? And so these 12-year-olds bring the pictures from their phones back and collaborate, because we can now, because we can upload these into a computer, we can get a projector and put them on the screen. And what text will we bring? Will we bring some text from Aldo Leopold or John Muir, some of our great conservationists, environmentalists? Will we bring those texts? Will we bring texts from Buddha, from the Eastern traditions? Will we bring texts from Scripture, from the Psalms? Will we bring these together in a new mosaic of what it means to experience God? Will we bring that together? And some of you out there who are, you know, proponents of a single tradition may also think of this in a single tradition way. Just bring your text, but let your people restate your own text, whether it's from the Torah, whether it's from the Quran, whether you are Unitarian, maybe you have your own text to bring. But how can you do it communally? And worship at all times, and if necessary, use words. That's St. Francis of Assisi. We in the West are so used to just using words, and unfortunately that's all I have today on this phone. But how many ways can we reveal what the divine is doing, and we are part of that divine?
You know, I have to share with
you. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, just something from paper 195 of the Urantia book, and it's after Pentecost in a section 9, Christianity's Problem, but it's just one paragraph. Sally, I think you'll really appreciate it because it was written in probably 1940, And just like so many spiritual texts, there's a timelessness, but also a wake-up call inherent in it. It says, the world needs more first-hand religion. Mm. Even Christianity, the best of the religions of the 20th century, is not only a religion about Jesus, but it is so largely one which men experience second-hand. They take their religion wholly as handed down by their accepted religious teachers. What an awakening the world would experience if it could only see Jesus as he really lived on earth and know firsthand his life-giving teachings. Descriptive words of things beautiful cannot thrill like the sight thereof. Neither can creedal words inspire men's souls like the experience of knowing the presence of God.
Yes.
But expectant faith will ever keep the hope door of man's soul open for the entrance of the eternal spirit realities of the divine values of the worlds beyond.
It's beautiful. Firsthand, I think you're absolutely right. People are longing for that. Now, I have, for many years, consulted with churches how to revive their worship, and I keep telling them it's out there, and they say, what do you mean it's out there? We're talking about in here. I said, no, anything worth doing in here really begins out there.
Mm.
And so one church I was consulting with, and this is often the case, these traditional churches, the neighborhoods are changing around them, and yet they don't change. And the demographic changes around them, and they don't change. And this congregation, the worship leader, worship director of this congregation, drove past an old abandoned hotel in a very bad part of town to get to this church. And he said, you know, there's got to be something that we can do with this. And it was a foreclosed property. It was and the homeless had started living in this congregation, living in this building. And he started talking to the worship team that he worked with about this, and they ended up
inspiring the church to buy the building and to redo this building, and their ministry, the locus of ministry, changed from their building to this other building and to the people who lived in it, who were one step away from the sidewalk. And then the relationship between these people, the stories that they brought, and many of them, immigrants and people who were alcoholics or drug addicts who had no place else to go when they were living in this building, and the things that then were done, a tutoring program, a clothing program, jobs program, all these things that were done, and then starting to partner with other agencies, non-faith-based agencies in the city, to give people a place to be, an in-between place. Another spiritual community in the Philadelphia area basically turned a church into a homeless shelter. They remade again. Here is this emergent. Life as we know it, church as we know it is done. And this is what I really believe, that religion as we know it is done in this country. And it needs to be. And we need to remake it in this new way so that our whatever centers and real estate that we have, either our locus of operation and our focus becomes our community. And the question people are asking is, what are you doing for this community? Sort of going back to the John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country will do for you, what will you do for your country? And religion everywhere in this country needs to ask that question, not what we are doing, what the community can do for us, or how many we can bring in, and how many we can convert. Not count the conversions, but the conversations. Or how about the commitments that we make to people in our community in terms of raising a basic quality of life? This is hands-on. So even though I have taught leaders how to be more collaborative and how to bring worship in that is more multi-sensory and more experiential, that's all great. But the best way to do that is actually to bring the stories of how we are partnering out in our neighborhood to change our neighborhoods hands-on, and to bring those stories back into our congregations, into our gatherings, which we still need. To bring those stories back in a multi-sensory experiential way. So you get double experiential. The experience of having changed, letting the community change us, and then to bring it back and show it in an experiential way.
When we look at what Jesus did, how he taught his apostles to teach, and how he taught people, individually, one-on-one, and the multitudes, was really totally outdoors, or mostly outdoors, was sometimes around, a meal, or sometimes around some other type of function. But there wasn't a lot of formality about it, and he was definitely going to them more than plopping himself down and expecting the multitudes to come to him.
And I think,
it was really all about being of service, finding ways to meet the needs of the crowd he's speaking to.
Yes.
There's this real fluidity in the way that happens, and in the way that he uses scripture, or the way that he uses metaphors and parables, and the way but mostly how he uses just hands-on love.
Yeah, absolutely. Jesus met people where they were in their language, which was story. He drew pictures.
Right.
And he met them geographically where they were. And he met them in life situation where they were. You can meet somebody geographically, but still wall yourself off from their life experience and their station, quote-unquote, in life. And you think about Jesus with the leper. All three of these are operating. He's speaking in a different sort of dialect to this leper. so that the communication was actually happening. He was in not in a building, you know, some kind of holy place, but out on the street. And actually proximity, just in terms of his empathy, was right there with this leper. Everybody else was afraid to touch. He was touching him. He was as close and hands-on as you could be with someone for whom, I mean, this was the epitome. The leper himself or herself was the metaphor of the untouchable. And this is how we've gotten it so wrong in terms of how we separate sacred from secular, what we call holy. I think in that moment, Jesus was calling holy the most unholy. And I want to read a little bit more of Barbara Brown Taylor. When I read earlier about the altar in the world, she said most of us have forgotten that the whole world is the house of God, and that somewhere along the line we bought or were sold the idea that God is chiefly interested in buildings. And so we mark these places. The divine really can erupt anywhere, and as with Jacob marked the place where he had the dream of God, of the angels ascending and descending on this ladder. He marked that place, Bethel, on that rock, the rock on which he laid his head. And she said, as important as it is to mark the places where we meet God, what happens when we build a house for God? Do we build God a house so that we can choose when to go see God? Do we build God a house in lieu of having God stay at ours? And what happens to the rest of the world when we build four walls, even four gorgeous walls, cap them with a steepled roof, and designate that the house of God? What happens to the riverbanks, the mountaintops, the desert, the trees? And what happens to the people who never show up in our houses of God? And then she says this: human beings may separate things into as many piles as we wish, separating spirit from flesh, sacred from secular, church from world. But we should not be surprised when God does not recognize the distinctions we make between the two. Earth is so thick with divine possibility that it is a wonder we can walk anywhere without cracking our shins on altars. God gave Jacob this vision. Jacob could see the angels going up and down from earth to heaven, going about their business in the one and only world there is.
Well, and you know, that's a really excellent segue once again to what I was hoping we would sort of move towards the end of the show. And believe it or not, we're here. The last 15 minutes, yeah. But, and that is to talk about your own personal journey into the world of integral philosophy and how that's had an effect on you and your thinking.
Yeah, it's had a huge effect.
And also the leadership in a flattened world kind of idea.
Yay.
Well, I discovered the world of integral quite by accident, maybe not accident, but began reading the work of Ken Wilber. I have so much respect for what he has done to help clarify all the possibilities and ways that we know, the ways that we know, the ways that we behave, the way that the universe interacts with itself. And I don't know how many of you listeners have been able to read Ken Wilber. I recommend The Integral Vision, which is a very short introduction to the integral approach. I love in the way that Ken gives us a quadrant of looking at exterior and interior, both the exterior of the individual at the individual level and the interior at the individual level. And that would be... on the individual, it would be our development, our emotional, psychological, thinking development, our worldview development, and then the exterior of the individual, how we evolved biologically, you know, from atoms to molecules and to the neural cord and the reptilian brain system and basically the evolution of humanity. And then there's the interior of the collective, which would be all of us on this planet, and how do you do that? That's really cultures, the development of cultures, and how we view life. Cultures are reflective of worldviews, how those develop. And he's drawn very much on the work of Don Beck in spiral dynamics there. And then the exterior collective, how we move from galaxies to planets to societies to groups, families, tribes, etc. So that has just been a marvelous clarifying journey for me to go through Wilbur's work, and I must also say the recent work of Steve McIntosh with his book Integral Consciousness, which I think, Steve, is filling out some areas of a question for me and helping to make Integral more accessible, because it can be a pretty complex world once you get into it. So I highly recommend Steve McIntosh's Integral Consciousness if you get into Integral and really want a condensation of that movement and the views of that movement. It would be great to read. More than anything, Integral has given me a picture of how my own faith, Christianity, fits within a larger picture of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I have loved being able to stand outside of Christianity and just see it as one expression, and a good one, but one expression among many. And of course, I've known this for many years. I've friends who are Buddhists, and I have friends who are Muslim, many different faith traditions. But even outside of the faith traditions that we know of, the world faith traditions, philosophies of life,
right.
Not just theologies, but philosophies of life.
Right.
And it inspired me to go back and start studying philosophy with more intent.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when I'm in conversations that are theological or, let's just say, ontological in terms of how the world came into being, and epistemological, how we know what we know, that's just so foundational. I the other night went to hear Deepak Chopra and Michael Shermer debate. Michael Shermer is editor of the Skeptic magazine. I think most of you know Deepak Chopra's work. And along with 10 other scientists as well as theologians. And the work of Integral to reintroduce me to basic philosophical approaches to life was key in understanding that two-hour debate.
Wow.
Into which, you know, Christianity fits in there somewhere, but even looking into the different types of Christianity, which Christianity, if you're talking
right.
about that, do you talk about? Is it the more, is it Western Christianity, which is more cognitive? It is more dualistic? Is it Orthodox? Is it Greek Orthodox, which is more holistic and tends to honor more of the body in incarnational views of Christianity, more material views. So it's helped me to understand that the little world that I grew up in, I get to look into a whole lot of different, a lot of backyards. I get to have that 10,000, 30,000, 50,000 foot view.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm now in real transition with my own faith, and that's a good thing. Then what's the nature of reality? Moving from a view of being separate from God to more integrated with God,
Mm-hmm. Wilbur's Three Faces of God have helped me a great deal in terms of the God that related to the pronouns, the God who is the related to the you. It's the I and thou. It is the God of the great traditions. It is the God who is separate. And then there's the God that is the God of the we, the God of oneness, the I am God, I am the divine. That's the God very much, you know, of Eastern tradition. And then there's the God of it. That is the third person.
Right.
So we went from, I didn't do them in order, the first person would be more of our Eastern religions, which would be the I, the second person the you, the third person the it, that would be nature and creation, the cosmos, science, the more empirical. To even have, to hold those three views of the divine in marvelous tension, I pretty much grew up with the I thou. Didn't understand the Eastern, and so I have been, you know, just greatly enriched by these three views and integrating them into my own experience. So I'm very much in transition with that. I will say that I'm coming more to a prismatic worldview instead of a worldview that is locked into one tradition. It is a prismatic or mosaic, and I can hold many of those lenses at one time and not feel like I have to choose, but they all enrich the other.
Right, right. Well, down to the last few minutes. Go ahead, Paula. Sorry.
Yeah, we have 8 minutes and we have a caller. Can we take a caller real quick?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. Area
Hello,
code 541.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi, ladies. This is Pam. Pamela Chaddock in Talent, Oregon. Yes. Hi.
Hey, Pam.
Great conversation, ladies. Sally, I couldn't let this conversation go by without coming on and saying how much I appreciated seeing your integral, beautiful presentation at the Christianity 21 in Minneapolis.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Kristalyn and I were privileged to be there, and you just absolutely, you brought it all together. You had audience participation with with ring tones, and you played your beautiful piano, and then not to mention the slideshow with your incredible photography and then the philosophy that went with those pictures. I mean, I was in awe, and I just really
appreciated
you.
Yeah, your photography is just amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Pam. That was a wonderful event with these 21 women. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, sure. Thank you. But you know what really struck me the most was after I think you were getting ready to leave, you and your fiancé, and I had just taken a moment to thank you. And I couldn't believe how humble you were. You just did this incredible, masterful presentation, and I thank you for it. And you acted like, really, was it really that good? I got that from you, and I don't know, you just have a wonderful presence about you, and I'm honoring what you've done and where you're going. And
thank you.
And this whole integral idea is I'm starting to grasp that myself. I really appreciate how valid it is.
It's a rich world. It just opens so many portals, and I'm glad that you have gotten into that. Obviously. It's just extraordinary.
Well, it is. How else can we experience the God of everything unless we try to integrate as much as possible?
Yes.
And like you were saying, you know, the philosophy, the science, the you know, the personal experience, the religion, all of that, you know, has a valid contribution to the conversation. And this conversation is just getting so full and rich. And I think what it's helping also is it's helping us to approach people in their own arena better, because we see how things fit within the whole.
Yes, yes.
You know?
And for us to be able to remove the barriers of judgment, of orthodoxy, of what we think is right, and to be in a more resonant, absorbent place. That's what I have wanted to be, Pam. I've wanted to be in that place to learn. I've spent so many years thinking that I had something to just tell, and I am only one piece. I'm here to listen better and to co-create with others.
Exactly. In fact, I just started getting involved with the whole emergent phenomenon. Having been a Urantius student for, 40-some years or so, I started finding out what this emergent phenomenon was. And I have been so educated by this group. And, it's like I feel like I've got something from the Urantia book I want to share, but it's like I'm learning so much that, it's you plug in wherever it's appropriate. And there is just so much to learn that it's nobody has the truth. You know, we all have a piece of it.
And that's the way it was meant to be. I truly believe that. It's humbling ourselves before each other, not just before a divine being, that too, but we are all divine, and humbling ourselves before each other and the wonder of what each of us brings every moment.
Yes.
If we simply open our eyes, it's taken me a long time to get to this place to do that.
Yes, me too, because so much of my lifetime has been like the religion about Jesus, learning about the view of Jesus and the cosmos from the point of view of the Urantia book, although I've been studying other things along the way. But it's only been more recently that the whole living experience of opens up all kinds of new avenues, horizons to appreciate other people's points of view. I mean, I don't know, it's hard to talk about this stuff, but it's like the outer and inner become they dance back and forth.
And creation is happening now as we open ourselves to it.
Yeah.
And that's the
greatest
thing. I feel younger. I feel more energy. I feel there's just not enough time to experience and to be and to collaborate enough.
Yes, exactly. I know, especially when you start getting integral and you start finding all these different directions that are so inspiring, and then, there's things to learn in that arena, and it's like, thank God we've got eternity.
That's right, we do. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Tim. Really, thank you a lot. Really lifted my day.
Oh, well, thank you. You're such a dear, and I had to give you the love.
Thank you. You did.
And you too, ladies. What a great conversation today.
Yeah.
This has been very inspiring.
Thanks,
well, thanks
Pam.
For all of the wonderful positive comments on the board. And Sally, thank you so much for joining us. It was just a slice of heaven. I can't tell you.
For me as well. We have created something new and are creating something new, and I thank you for this show. I really thank you for doing this. It takes persistence, a lot of detail, a lot of work to do this, both of you, Crystalline and Paul.
Thank you.
We're sure enjoying it.
We love doing it.
Like you.
Well, that's obvious.
And it's one of the ways that we really get to be involved in that collaboration. It's such a creative process for us also, being able to connect with our mentors, with our heroes, with the people whose writings really inspire us. And we just so look forward to having you here, and it's been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a blessing having you with us. Thank you for all your personal and deep sharing.
Oh.
Yes, I love that poem by Stafford.
Isn't that poem?
What is the name of that poem?
The poem that I read, let's see, I'm just trying to bring it up here, and I'm not bringing it up.
That's all right.
Well, there are a couple of books, A Course on Creative Writing and You Must Revise Your Life. Those two books, you'll find those poems in there.
Okay.
Can I read one last one?
Sure.
Oh, yes.
We have gone off the air, but for all of our archive listeners, they will be able to hear this. So go ahead.
Fantastic. All right, I'll read it. Yellow Cars. Some of the cars are yellow that go by, those you look at, so glimmering when light glances at their passing. Think of that hope. Someone will like me, maybe. The tan ones don't care. The blue ones have made a mistake. The white haven't tried, but the yellow. Turn your head. Hope lasts a long time when you're happy.
That's great. I'll never see a yellow car any differently now. It's like that's beautiful.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. Have a great day.
Yes.
Thank
later.
You,
yeah.
Sally. Have a wonderful week.
All right. I'm sure I will.
I'll be in touch with you.
Bye bye.
And we hope you'll come back and join us again.
Oh, I would love to. Yes. Tell me anytime. Yeah. I would love to.
Terrific.
Maybe we'll get you. You and Steve McIntosh on together, that would be fun.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. I would love it. That'd be fun.
Right.
Let's do that. Let's get that together.
Right. We'll work on that.
Super.
Bye. Thank you
so much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Oh. Hey, ladies. So that was great. Nice.
Thank you. Thanks for all your help on the board, too.
Oh, sure.
All right, love you. Till the next one.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.